The Little Sisters of Illuria. Read by Boyd Gaines.
Author's note. The Dark Tower books begin with Roland of Gilead, the last gunslinger in an exhausted world that has moved on, pursuing a magician in a black robe. Roland has been chasing Walter for a very long time. In the first book of the cycle, he finally catches up. This story, however, takes place while Roland is still casting about for Walter's trail. One. Full earth. The empty town. The bells. The dead boy. The overturned wagon. The green folk. On a day in full earth so hot that it seemed to suck the breath from his chest before his body could use it, Roland of Gilead came to the gates of a village in the Desatoya Mountains. He was traveling alone by then, and would soon be traveling afoot as well. This whole last week he had been hoping for a horse doctor, but guessed such a fellow would do him no good now, even if this town had one. His mount, a 2-year-old roan, was pretty well done for. The town gates, still decorated with flowers from some festival or other, stood open and welcoming, but the silence beyond them was all wrong. The gunslinger heard no clip-clop of horses, no rumble of wagon wheels, no merchants' huckstering cries from the marketplace. The only sounds were the low hum of crickets, some sort of bug at any rate. They were a bit more tuneful than crickets at that. A queer wooden knocking sound, and the faint, dreamy tinkle of small bells. Also, the flowers twined through the wrought iron staves of the ornamental gate were long dead. Between his knees, Topsy gave 2 great hollow sneezes, ka-chow, ka-chow, and staggered sideways. Roland dismounted, partly out of respect for the horse, partly out of respect for himself. He didn't want to break a leg under Topsy if Topsy chose this moment to give up and canter into the clearing at the end of his path. The gunslinger stood in his dusty boots and faded jeans under the beating sun, stroking the roan's matted neck, pausing every now and then to yank his fingers through the tangles of Topsy's mane, and stopping once to shoo off the tiny flies clustering at the corners of Topsy's eyes. Let them lay their eggs and hatch their maggots there after Topsy was dead, but not before. Roland thus honored his horse as best he could, listening to those distant, dreamy bells and the strange wooden talking sound as he did. After a while, he ceased his absent grooming and looked thoughtfully at the open gate. The cross above its center was a bit unusual, but otherwise the gate was a typical example of its type. A western commonplace, which was not useful, but traditional. All the little towns he had come to in the last 10 months seemed to have one such where you came in, grand, and one more such where you went out, not so grand. None had been built to exclude visitors, certainly not this one. It stood between 2 walls of pink adobe that ran into the scree for a distance of about 20 feet on either side of the road, and then simply stopped. Close the gate, lock it with many locks, and all that meant was a short walk around one bit of adobe wall or the other. Beyond the gate, Roland could see what looked in most respects like a perfectly ordinary high street. An inn, 2 saloons, one of which was called the Bustling Pig, the sign over the other was too faded to read, a mercantile, a smithy, a gathering hall. There was also a small but rather lovely wooden building with a modest bell tower on top, a sturdy fieldstone foundation on the bottom, and a gold-painted cross on its double doors. The cross, like the one over the gate, marked this as a worshiping place for those who held to the Jesus man. This wasn't a common religion in Midworld, but far from unknown. That same thing could have been said about most forms of worship in those days, including the worship of Baal, Asmodeus, and 100 others. Faith, like everything else in the world these days, had moved on. As far as Roland was concerned, God or the cross was just another religion which taught that love and murder were inextricably bound together, that in the end, God always drank blood. Meanwhile, there was the singing hum of insects that sounded almost like crickets, the dreamlike tinkle of the bells, and that queer wooden thumping like a fist on a door or on a coffin top. "Something here's a long way from right," the gunslinger thought. "Where, Roland? This place has a reddish odor." He led Topsy through the gate with its adornments of dead flowers and down the high street. On the porch of the mercantile, where the old men should have congregated to discuss crops, politics, and the follies of the younger generation, there stood only a line of empty rockers. Lying beneath one, as if dropped from a careless and long-departed hand, was a charred corncob pipe. The hitching rack in front of the bustling pig stood empty. The windows of the saloon itself were dark. One of the bat-wing doors had been yanked off and stood propped against the side of the building. The other hung ajar, its faded green slats spattered with maroon stuff that might have been paint, but probably wasn't. The shop front of the livery stable stood intact, like the face of a ruined woman who has access to good cosmetics, but the double barn behind it was a charred skeleton. That fire must have happened on a rainy day, the gunslinger thought, or the whole damn town would have gone up in flames. A jolly spin and raree show for anyone around to see it. To his right now, halfway up to where the street opened into the town square, was the church. There were grassy borders on both sides, one separating the church from the town's gathering hall, the other from the little house set aside for the preacher and his family, if this was one of the Jesus sects which allowed its shamans to have wives and families, that was. Some of them, clearly administered by lunatics, demanded at least the appearance of celibacy. There were flowers in these grassy strips, and while they looked parched, most were still alive. So whatever had happened here to empty the place out had not happened long ago, a week perhaps, two at the outside, given the heat. Topsy sneezed again, "Kachow!" and lowered his head wearily. The gunslinger saw the source of the tinkling. Above the cross on the church doors, a cord had been strung in a long, shallow arc. Hung from it were perhaps 24 tiny silver bells. There was hardly any breeze today, but enough so these smalls were never quite still. And if a real wind should rise, Roland thought, the sound made by the tintinnabulation of the bells would probably be a good deal less pleasant, more like the strident parley of gossips' tongues. "Hello," Roland called, looking across the street at what a large false-fronted sign proclaimed to be the Good Beds Hotel.
"Hello, the town."
No answer but the bells, the tunesome insects, and that odd wooden clunking. No answer, no movement. But there were folk here. Folk or something. He was being watched. The tiny hairs on the nape of his neck had stiffened. Roland stepped onward, leading Topsy toward the center of town, puffing up the unlaid high street dust with each step. 40 paces farther along, he stopped in front of a low building marked with a single curt word, "Law." The sheriff's office, if they had such this far from the inners, looked remarkably similar to the church, Wooden boards stained a rather forbidding shade of dark brown above a stone foundation. The bells behind him rustled and whispered. He left the roan standing in the middle of the street and mounted the steps to the law office. He was very aware of the bells, of the sun beating against his neck, and of the sweat trickling down his sides. The door was shut, but unlocked. He opened it, then winced back, half raising a hand as the heat trapped inside rushed out in a soundless gasp. If all the closed buildings were this hot inside, he mused, the livery barns would soon not be the only burnt-out hulks. And with no rain to stop the flames, and certainly no volunteer fire department, not anymore, the town would not be long for the face of the earth. He stepped inside, trying to sip at the stifling air rather than taking deep breaths. He immediately heard the low drone of flies. There was a single cell, commodious and empty, its barred door standing open. Filthy skin shoes, one of the pair coming unsewn, lay beneath a bunk sodden with the same dried maroon stuff that had marked the bustling pig. Here was where the flies were, crawling over the stain, feeding from it. On the desk was a ledger. Roland turned it toward him and read what was embossed upon its red cover. Registry of Misdeeds and Redress. In the Years of Our Lord. Elluria. So now he knew the name of the town, at least. Elluria. Pretty, but somehow ominous as well. But any name would have seemed ominous, Roland supposed, given these circumstances. He turned to leave and saw a closed door secured by a wooden bolt. He went to it, stood before it for a moment, then drew one of the big revolvers he carried low on his hips. He stood a moment longer, head down, thinking. Cuthbert, his old friend, liked to say that the wheels inside Roland's head ground slow but exceedingly fine, and then retracted the bolt. He opened the door and immediately stood back, leveling his gun, expecting a body, Elluria's sheriff, mayhap, to come tumbling into the room with his throat cut and his eyes gouged out, victim of a misdeed in need of redress. Nothing. Well, half a dozen stained jumpers, which longer-term prisoners were probably required to wear, two bows, a quiver of arrows, an old dusty motor, a rifle that had probably last been fired 100 years ago, and a mop. But in the gunslinger's mind, all that came down to nothing. Just a storage closet. He went back to the desk, opened the register, and leafed through it. Even the pages were warm, as if the book had been baked. In a way, he supposed it had been. If the high street layout had been different, he might have expected a large number of religious offenses to be recorded, but he wasn't surprised to find none here. If the Jesus Man Church had coexisted with a couple of saloons, the church folk must have been fairly reasonable. What Roland found was the usual petty offenses, and a few not so petty. A murder, a horse thieving, the distressal of a lady, which probably meant rape. The murderer had been removed to a place called Lexingworth to be hanged. Roland had never heard of it. One note toward the end read, "Green folk sent hence." It meant nothing to Roland. The most recent entry was this: 12 FE 99, Charles Freeborn, cattle thief, to be tried. Roland wasn't familiar with the notation 12 FE 99, but as this was a long stretch from February, he supposed FE might stand for full earth. In any case, the ink looked about as fresh as the blood on the bunk in the cell, and the gunslinger had a good idea that Charles Freeborn, cattle thief, had reached the clearing at the end of his path. He went out into the heat and the lacy sound of bells. Topsy looked at Roland dully, then lowered his head again, as if there were something in the dust of the high street which could be cropped, as if he would ever want to crop again, for that matter. The gunslinger gathered up the reins, slapped the dust off them against the faded no color of his jeans, and continued on up the street. The wooden knocking sound grew steadily louder as he walked. He had not holstered his gun when leaving Law, nor cared to holster it now. And as he neared the town square, which must have housed the Alluria market in more normal times, Roland at last saw movement. On the far side of the square was a long watering trough made of ironwood from the look, what some called sequoia out here, apparently fed in happier times from a rusty steel pipe which now jutted waterless above the trough's south end. Lolling over one side of this municipal oasis, about halfway down its length, was a leg clad in faded gray pants and terminating in a well-chewed cowboy boot. The chewer was a large dog, perhaps two shades grayer than the corduroy pants. Under other circumstances, Roland supposed the mutt would have had the boot off long since, but perhaps the foot and lower calf inside it had swelled. In any case, the dog was well on its way to simply chewing the obstacle away. It would seize the boot and shake it back and forth. Every now and then the boot's heel would collide with the wooden side of the trough, producing another hollow knock. The gunslinger hadn't been so wrong to think of coffin tops after all, it seemed.
Why doesn't it just back off a few steps, jump in the trough, and have at him? Roland wondered. No water coming out of the pipe, so it can't be afraid of drowning.
Topsy uttered another of his hollow, tired sneezes, and when the dog lurched around in response, Roland understood why it was doing things the hard way. One of its front legs had been badly broken and crookedly mended. Walking would be a chore for it, jumping out of the question. On its chest was a patch of dirty white fur. Growing out of this patch was black fur in a roughly cruciform shape. A Jesus dog, mayhap, hoping for a spot of afternoon communion. There was nothing very religious about the snarl which began to wind out of its chest, however, or the roll of its rheumy eyes. It lifted its upper lip in a trembling sneer, revealing a goodish set of teeth.
"Light out," Roland said, "while you can."
The dog backed up until its hindquarters were pressed against the chewed boot. It regarded the oncoming man fearfully, but clearly meant to stand its ground. The revolver in Roland's hand held no significance for it. The gunslinger wasn't surprised. He guessed the dog had never seen one, had no idea it was anything other than a club of some kind which could only be thrown once.
"High on with you now," Roland said, but still the dog wouldn't move. He should have shot it. It was no good to itself, and a dog that had acquired a taste for human flesh could be no good to anyone else. But he somehow didn't like to.
Killing the only thing still living in this town, other than the singing bugs, that was, seemed like an invitation to bad luck. He fired into the dust near the dog's good forepaw, the sound crashing into the hot day and temporarily silencing the insects. The dog could run, it seemed, although at a lurching trot that hurt Roland's eyes and his heart a little too. It stopped at the far side of the square by an overturned flatbed wagon. There looked to be more dried blood splashed on the freighter's side, and glanced back. It uttered a forlorn howl that raised the hairs on the nape of Roland's neck even further. Then it turned, skirted the wrecked wagon, and limped down a lane which opened between two of the stalls. This way toward Illuria's back gate, Roland guessed. Still leading his dying horse, the gunslinger crossed the square to the ironwood trough and looked in. The owner of the chewed boot wasn't a man, but a boy who had just been beginning to get his man's growth. And that would have been quite a large growth indeed, Roland judged, even setting aside the bloating effects which had resulted from being immersed for some unknown length of time in 9 inches of water simmering under a summer sun. The boy's eyes, now just milky balls, stared blindly up at the gunslinger like the eyes of a statue. His hair appeared to be the white of old age, although that was the effect of the water. He had likely been a towhead. His clothes were those of a cowboy, although he couldn't have been much more than 14 or 16. Around his neck, gleaming blearily in the water that was slowly turning into a skin stew under the summer sun, was a gold medallion. Roland reached into the water, not liking to, but feeling a certain obligation. He wrapped his fingers around the medallion and pulled. The chain parted, and he lifted the thing, dripping, into the air. He rather expected a Jesus man sigil, what was called the crucifix or the rood, but a small rectangle hung from the chain instead. The object looked like pure gold. Engraved into it was this legend: James, loved of family, loved of God. Roland, who had been almost too revolted to reach into the polluted water, as a younger man he never could have brought himself to that, was now glad he'd done it. He might never run into any of those who had loved this boy, but he knew enough of Ka to think it might be so. In any case, it was the right thing. So was giving the kid a decent burial, assuming that was he could get the body out of the trough without having it break apart inside the clothes. Roland was considering this, trying to balance what might be his duty in this circumstance against his growing desire to get out of this town, when Topsy finally fell dead. The roan went over with a creak of gear and a last waffling groan as it hit the ground. Roland turned and saw 8 people in the street walking toward him in a line, like beaters who hope to flush out birds or drive small game. Their skin was waxy green. Folk wearing such skin would likely glow in the dark like ghosts. It was hard to tell their sex, and what could it matter, to them or anyone else? They were slow mutants, walking with the hunched deliberation of corpses reanimated by some arcane magic. The dust had muffled their feet like carpet. With the dog banished, they might well have gotten within attacking distance if Topsy hadn't done Roland the favor of dying at such an opportune moment. No guns that Roland could see. They were armed with clubs. These were chair legs and table legs for the most part, but Roland saw one that looked made rather than seized. It had a bristle of rusty nails sticking out of it, and he suspected it had once been the property of a saloon bouncer, possibly the one who kept school in the Bustling Pig. Roland raised his pistol, aiming at the fellow in the center of the line. Now he could hear the shuffle of their feet and the wet snuffle of their breathing, as if they all had bad chest colds. Came out of the mines, most likely, Roland thought. There are radium mines somewhere about. That would account for the skin. I wonder that the sun doesn't kill them. Then, as he watched, the one on the end, a creature with a face like melted candle wax, did die, or collapsed at any rate. Roland was quite sure it was a male, went to his knees with a low, gobbling cry, groping for the hand of the thing walking next to it, something with a lumpy, bald head and red sores sizzling on its neck. This creature took no notice of its fallen companion, but kept its dim eyes on Roland, lurching along in rough step with its remaining companions. "Stop where you are," Roland said. "Wear me if you'd live to see day's end. Wear me very well." He spoke mostly to the one in the center who wore ancient red suspenders over rags of shirt and a filthy bowler hat. This gent had only one good eye, and it peered at the gunslinger with a greed as horrible as it was unmistakable. The one beside bowler hat, Roland believed this one might be a woman with the dangling vestiges of breasts beneath the vest it wore, threw the chair leg it held. The arc was true, but the missile fell 10 yards short. Roland thumbed back the trigger of his revolver and fired again. This time the dirt displaced by the slug kicked up on the tattered remains of Bowler Hat's shoe instead of on a lame dog's paw.
The green folk didn't run as the dog had, but they stopped, staring at him with their dull greed. Had the missing folk of Aluria finished up in these creatures' stomachs? Roland couldn't believe it, although he knew perfectly well that such as these held no scruple against cannibalism. And perhaps it wasn't cannibalism, not really. How could such things as these be considered human, whatever they might once have been? They were too slow, too stupid. If they had dared come back into town after the sheriff had run them out, they would have been burned or stoned to death. Without thinking about what he was doing, wanting only to free his other hand to draw his second gun if the apparitions didn't see reason, Roland stuffed the medallion that he had taken from the dead boy into the pocket of his jeans, pushing the broken fine-link chain in after. They stood staring at him, their strangely twisted shadows drawn out behind them. What next? Tell them to go back where they'd come from? Roland didn't know if they'd do it, and in any case had decided he liked them best where he could see them. And at least there was no question now about staying to bury the boy named James. That conundrum had been solved.
"Stand steady," he said in the low speech, beginning to retreat. "First fellow that moves."
Before he could finish, one of them, a thick-chested troll with a pouty toad's mouth and what looked like gills on the sides of his wattled neck, lunged forward, gibbering in a high-pitched and peculiarly flabby voice. It might have been a species of laughter. He was waving what looked like a piano leg. Roland fired. Mr. Toad's chest caved in like a bad piece of roofing. He ran backward several steps, trying to catch his balance and clawing at his chest with the hand not holding the piano leg. His feet, clad in dirty red velvet slippers with curled-up toes, tangled in each other and he fell over, making a queer and somehow lonely gargling sound. He let go of his club, rolled over on one side, tried to rise, and then fell back into the dust. The brutal sun glared into his open eyes, and as Roland watched, white tendrils of steam began to rise from his skin, which was rapidly losing its green undertint. There was also a hissing sound, like a gob of spit on top of a hot stove.
Saves explaining, at least, Roland thought, and swept his eyes over the others.
All right, he was the first one to move. Who wants to be the second?
None did, it seemed. They only stood there watching him, not coming at him, but not retreating either. He thought, as he had about the cross dog, that he should kill them as they stood there, just draw his other gun and mow them down. It would be the work of seconds only, and child's play to his gifted hands, even if some ran. But he couldn't. Not just cold like that. He wasn't that kind of killer. At least, not yet. Very slowly he began to step backward, first bending his course around the watering trough, then putting it between him and them. When Bowler Hat took a step forward, Roland didn't give the others in the line a chance to copy him. He put a bullet into the dust of the high street an inch in advance of Bowler Hat's foot.
"That's your last warning," he said, still using the low speech.
He had no idea if they understood it, didn't really care. He guessed they caught this tune's music well enough.
"Next bullet I fire eats up someone's heart. The way it works is you stay and I go. You get this one chance. Follow me and you all die. It's too hot to play games, and I've lost my—"
"Boo!"
cried a rough, liquidy voice from behind him. There was unmistakable glee in it. Roland saw a shadow grow from the shadow of the overturned freight wagon, which he had now almost reached, and had just time to understand that another of the green folk had been hiding beneath it. As he began to turn, a club crashed down on Roland's shoulder, numbing his right arm all the way to the wrist. He held on to the gun and fired once, but the bullet went into one of the wagon wheels, smashing a wooden spoke and turning the wheel on its hub with a high screeching sound. Behind him he heard the green folk in the street uttering hoarse, yapping cries as they charged forward.
The thing which had been hiding beneath the overturned wagon was a monster with two heads growing out of his neck, one with the vestigial slack face of a corpse. The other, although just as green, was more lively. Broad lips spread in a cheerful grin as he raised his club to strike again. Roland drew with his left hand, the one that wasn't numbed and distant. He had time to put one bullet through the bushwhacker's grin, flinging him backward in a spray of blood and teeth, the bludgeon flying out of his relaxing fingers. Then the others were on him, clubbing and drubbing. The gunslinger was able to slip the first couple of blows, and there was one moment when he thought he might be able to spin around to the rear of the overturned wagon, spin and turn and go to work with his guns. Surely he would be able to do that. Surely his quest for the Dark Tower wasn't supposed to end on the sun-blasted street of a little far western town called Illuria, at the hands of half a dozen green-skinned slow mutants. Surely Ka could not be so cruel. But Bowler Hat caught him with a vicious side-hand blow, and Roland crashed into the wagon's slowly spinning rear wheel instead of skirting around it. As he went to his hands and knees, still scrambling and trying to turn, trying to evade the blows which rained down on him, he saw there were now many more than half a dozen. Coming up the street toward the town square were at least 30 green men and women. This wasn't a clan, but a damned tribe of them, and in broad, hot daylight. Slow mutants were, in his experience, creatures that loved the dark, almost like toadstools with brains, and he had never seen any such as these before. The one in the red vest was female. Her bare breast swinging beneath the dirty red vest were the last things he saw clearly as they gathered around and above him, bashing away with their clubs. The one with the nails studded in it came down on his lower right calf, sinking its stupid rusty fangs in deep. He tried again to raise one of the big guns. His vision was fading now, but that wouldn't help them if he got to shooting. He had always been the most hellishly talented of them. Jamie DeCurry had once proclaimed that Roland could shoot blindfolded because he had eyes in his fingers. And it was kicked out of his hand and into the dust. Although he could still feel the smooth sandalwood grip of the other, he thought it was nevertheless already gone. He could smell them, the rich, rotted smell of decaying meat. Or was that only his hands, as he raised them in a feeble and useless effort to protect his head? His hands, which had been in the polluted water where flecks and strips of the dead boy's skin floated? The club slamming down on him, slamming down all over him, as if the green folk wanted not just to beat him to death, but to tenderize him as they did so. And as he went down into the darkness of what he most certainly believed would be his death, he heard the bugs singing, the dog he had spared barking, and the bells hung on the church door ringing. These sounds merged together into strangely sweet music. Then that was gone, too. The darkness ate it all.
2.
Rising, hanging suspended, white beauty, two others, the medallion. The gunslinger's return to the world wasn't like coming back to consciousness after a blow, which he'd done several times before. And it wasn't like waking from sleep, either. It was like rising. I'm dead, he thought at some point during this process, when the power to think had been at least partially restored to him. Dead and rising into whatever afterlife there is. That's what it must be. The singing I hear is the singing of dead souls. Total blackness gave way to the dark gray of rain clouds, then to the lighter gray of fog. This brightened to the uniform clarity of a heavy mist moments before the sun breaks through. And through it all was that sense of rising, as if he had been caught in some mild but powerful updraft. As the sense of rising began to diminish, and the brightness behind his eyelids grew, Roland at last began to believe he was still alive. It was the singing that convinced him. not dead souls, not the heavenly host of angels sometimes described by the Jesus Man preachers, but only those bugs. A little like crickets, but sweeter voiced. The ones he had heard in Aluria. On this thought, he opened his eyes. His belief that he was still alive was severely tried, for Roland found himself hanging suspended in a world of white beauty. His first bewildered thought was that he was in the sky, floating within a fair-weather cloud. All around him was the reedy singing of the bugs. Now he could hear the tinkling of bells, too. He tried to turn his head and swayed in some sort of harness. He could hear it creaking. The soft singing of the bugs, like crickets in the grass at the end of day back home in Gilead, hesitated and broke rhythm. When it did, what felt like a tree of pain grew up Roland's back. He had no idea what its burning branches might be, but the trunk was surely his spine. A far deadlier pain sank into one of his lower legs. In his confusion, the gunslinger could not tell which one. "That's where the club with the nails in it got me," he thought. And more pain in his head. His skull felt like a badly cracked egg. He cried out and could hardly believe that the harsh crow's call he heard came from his own throat. He thought he could also hear very faintly the barking of the cross dog. But surely that was his imagination. "Am I dying? Have I awakened once more at the very end?" A hand stroked his brow. He could feel it, but not see it, fingers trailing across his skin, pausing here and there to massage a knot or a line. Delicious, like a drink of cool water on a hot day. He began to close his eyes, and then a horrible idea came to him. Suppose that hand were green, its owner wearing a tattered red vest over her hanging dugs.
"What if it is? What could you do?"
"Hush, man," a young woman's voice said. Or perhaps it was the voice of a girl. Certainly the first person Roland thought of was Susan, the girl from Magus, she who had spoken to him as thee.
Where...
"Hush, stir not. 'Tis far too soon." The pain in his back was subsiding now, but the image of the pain as a tree remained, for his very skin seemed to be moving like leaves in a light breeze. How could that be? He let the question go, let all questions go, and concentrated on the small, cool hand stroking his brow. "Hush, pretty man. God's love be upon ye. Yet it's sore hurt ye are. Be still, heal." The dog had hushed its barking, if it had ever been there in the first place, and Roland became aware of that low creaking sound again. It reminded him of horse tethers or something, hang ropes, he didn't like to think of. Now he believed he could feel pressure beneath his thighs, his buttocks, and perhaps, yes, his shoulders.
"I'm not in a bed at all. I think I'm above a bed. Can that be?"
He supposed he could be in a sling. He seemed to remember once as a boy that some fellow had been suspended that way in the horse doctor's room behind the great hall, a stable hand who had been burned too badly by kerosene to be laid in a bed. The man had died, but not soon enough. For 2 nights his shrieks had filled the sweet summer air of the gathering fields.
"Am I burned, then? Nothing but a cinder with legs hanging in a sling?"
The fingers touched the center of his brow, rubbing away the frown forming there. And it was as if the voice which went with the hand had read his thoughts, picking them up with the tips of her clever, soothing fingers.
"Ye'll be fine if God wills, Si,"
the voice which went with the hand said.
"But time belongs to God, not to you."
"No," he would have said if he had been able. "Time belongs to the tower."
Then he slipped down again, descending as smoothly as he had risen, going away from the hand and the dreamlike sounds of the singing insects and chiming bells. There was an interval that might have been sleep or perhaps unconsciousness, but he never went all the way back down. At one point he thought he heard the girl's voice, although he couldn't be sure because this time it was raised in fury or fear or both. "No," she cried. "Ye can't have it off him, and ye know it. Go your course and stop talking of it, do." When he rose back to consciousness the second time, he was no stronger in body, but a little more himself in mind. What he saw when he opened his eyes wasn't the inside of a cloud, but at first that same phrase, white beauty, recurred to him. It was in some ways the most beautiful place Roland had ever been in his life, partially because he still had a life, of course, but mostly because it was so fey and peaceful. It was a huge room, high and long. When Roland at last turned his head, cautiously, so cautiously, to take its measure as well as he could, he thought it must run at least 200 yards from end to end. It was built narrow, but its height gave the place a feeling of tremendous airiness. There were no walls or ceilings such as those he was familiar with, although it was a little like being in a vast tent. Above him, the sun struck and diffused its light across billowy panels of thin white silk, turning them into the bright swags that he had first mistaken for clouds. Beneath this silk canopy, the room was as gray as twilight. The walls, also silk, rippled like sails in a faint breeze. Hanging from each wall panel was a curved rope bearing small bells. These lay against the fabric and rang in low and charming unison, like wind chimes when the walls rippled. An aisle ran down the center of the long room. On either side of it were scores of beds, each made up with clean white sheets and headed with crisp white pillows. There were perhaps 40 on the far side of the aisle, all empty, and another 40 on Roland's side. There were two other occupied beds here, one next to Roland on his right. This fellow. It's the boy. The one who was in the trough. The idea ran goosebumps up Roland's arms and gave him a nasty, superstitious start. He peered more closely at the sleeping boy. Can't be. You're just dazed, that's all. It can't be. Yet closer scrutiny refused to dispel the idea. It certainly seemed to be the boy from the trough, probably ill, why else would he be in a place like this, but far from dead. Roland could see the slow rise and fall of his chest and the occasional twitch of the fingers that dangled over the side of the bed. You didn't get a good enough look at him to be sure of anything, and after a few days in that trough, his own mother couldn't have said for sure who it was. But Roland, who'd had a mother, knew better than that. He also knew that he'd seen the gold medallion around the boy's neck. Just before the attack of the green folk, he had taken it from this lad's corpse and put it in his pocket. Now someone, the proprietors of this place most likely, those who had sorcerously restored the lad named James to his interrupted life, had taken it back from Roland and put it around the boy's neck again. Had the girl with the wonderfully cool hand done that? Did she in consequence think Roland a ghoul who would steal from the dead? He didn't think so. In fact, the notion made him more uncomfortable than the idea that the young cowboy's bloated body had been somehow returned to its normal size and then reanimated. Farther down the aisle on this side, perhaps a dozen empty beds away from the boy and Roland S. Chain, the gunslinger saw a third inmate of this queer infirmary. This fellow looked at least four times the age of the lad, twice the age of the gunslinger. He had a long beard, more gray than black, that hung to his upper chest in two straggly forks. The face above it was sun-darkened, heavily lined, and pouched beneath the eyes. Running from his left cheek and across the bridge of his nose was a thick, dark mark which Roland took to be a scar. The bearded man was either asleep or unconscious. Roland could hear him snoring, and was suspended 3 feet above his bed, held up by a complex series of white belts that glimmered in the dim air. These crisscrossed each other, making a series of figure eights all the way around the man's body. He looked like a bug in some exotic spider's web. He wore a gauzy white beddress. One of the belts ran beneath his buttocks, elevating his crotch in a way that seemed to offer the bulge of his privates to the gray and dreaming air. Farther down his body, Roland could see the dark shadow shapes of his legs. They appeared to be twisted like ancient dead trees. Roland didn't like to think in how many places they must have been broken to look like that. And yet, they appeared to be moving. How could they be if the bearded man was unconscious? It was a trick of the light, perhaps. Or of the shadows. Perhaps the gauzy singlet the man was wearing was stirring in a light breeze, or... Roland looked away, up at the billowy silk panels high above, trying to control the accelerating beat of his heart. What he saw hadn't been caused by the wind or a shadow or anything else. The man's legs were somehow moving without moving, as Roland had seemed to feel his own back moving without moving. He didn't know what could cause such a phenomenon, and didn't want to know, at least not yet. "I'm not ready," he whispered. His lips felt very dry. He closed his eyes again, wanting to sleep, wanting not to think about what the bearded man's twisted legs might indicate about his own condition. But
you'd better get ready.
That was the voice that always seemed to come when he tried to slack off, to scamp a job or take the easy way around an obstacle. It was the voice of Court, his old teacher, the man whose stick they had all feared as boys. They hadn't feared his stick as much as his mouth, however. His jeers when they were weak, his contempt when they complained or tried whining about their lot.
"Are you a gunslinger, Roland? If you are, you better get ready."
Roland opened his eyes again and turned his head to the left again. As he did, he felt something shift against his chest. Moving very slowly, he raised his right hand out of the sling that held it. The pain in his back stirred and muttered. He stopped moving until he decided the pain was going to get no worse, if he was careful at least, then lifted the hand the rest of the way to his chest. It encountered finely woven cloth, cotton. He moved his chin to his breastbone and saw that he was wearing a beddress like the one draped on the body of the bearded man. Roland reached beneath the neck of the gown and felt a fine chain. A little farther down, his fingers encountered a rectangular metal shape. He thought he knew what it was, but had to be sure. He pulled it out, still moving with great care, trying not to engage any of the muscles in his back. A gold medallion. He dared the pain, lifting it until he could read what was engraved upon it. James. Loved of family. Loved of God. He tucked it into the top of the beddress again and looked back at the sleeping boy in the next bed. In it, not suspended over it. The sheet was only pulled up to the boy's rib cage, and the medallion lay on the pristine white breast of his beddress. The same medallion Roland now wore, except... Roland thought he understood, and understanding was a relief. He looked back at the bearded man and saw an exceedingly strange thing. The thick black line of scar across the bearded man's cheek and nose was gone. Where it had been was the pinkish-red mark of a healing wound, a cut, or perhaps a slash.
I imagined it.
"No, gunslinger," Court's voice returned. "Such as you was not made to imagine, as well you know."
The little bit of movement had tired him out again, or perhaps it was the thinking which had really tired him out. The singing bugs and chiming bells combined had made something too much like a lullaby to resist. This time, when Roland closed his eyes, he slept. 3. five sisters, Jenna, the doctors of Illuria, the medallion, a promise of silence. When Roland awoke again, he was at first sure that he was still sleeping, dreaming, having a nightmare. Once, at the time he had met and fallen in love with Susan Delgado, he had known a witch named Rhea, the first real witch of Midworld he had ever met. It was she who had caused Susan's death, although Roland had played his own part. Now, opening his eyes and seeing Rhea not just once but five times over, he thought, "This is what comes of remembering those old times. By conjuring Susan, I've conjured Rhea of the Coos as well, Rhea and her sisters." The five were dressed in billowing habits as white as the walls and the panels of the ceiling. Their antique crones' faces were framed in wimples just as white, their skin as gray and runneled as droughted earth by comparison. Hanging like phylacteries from the bands of silk imprisoning their hair, if indeed they had hair, were lines of tiny bells which chimed as they moved or spoke. Upon the snowy breast of their habits was embroidered a blood-red rose, the sigil of the Dark Tower. Seeing this, Roland thought, "I'm not dreaming. These Harridans are real."
"He wakes!"
one of them cried in a gruesomely coquettish voice.
"Ooh! Ooh! Ah!"
They fluttered like birds. The one in the center stepped forward, and as she did, their faces seemed to shimmer like the silk walls of the ward. They weren't old after all, he saw, middle-aged, perhaps, but not old. Yes, they are old. They changed. The one who now took charge was taller than the others, and with a broad, slightly bulging brow. She bent toward Roland, and the bells that fringed her forehead tinkled. The sound made him feel sick somehow, and weaker than he had felt a moment before. Her hazel eyes were intent, greedy, mayhap. She touched his cheek for a moment, and a numbness seemed to spread there. Then she glanced down, and a look which could have been disquiet cramped her face. She took her hand back.
"Ye wake, pretty man, so ye do. 'Tis well."
"Who are you? Where am I?"
"We are the little sisters of Illuria," she said. "I am Sister Mary. Here is Sister Louise, and Sister Michella, and Sister Coquina." "And Sister Tamra," said the last. "A lovely lass of 21.
She giggled. Her face shimmered, and for a moment she was again as old as the world, hooked of nose, gray of skin. Roland thought once more of Rhea. They moved closer, encircling the complication of harness in which he lay suspended, and when Roland shrank back, the pain roared up his back and injured leg again. He groaned. The straps holding him creaked.
"Ooh, it hurts. Hurts him! Hurts so fierce!"
They pressed even closer, as if his pain fascinated them. And now he could smell them, a dry and earthy smell. The one named Sister Michella reached out.
"Go away! Leave him! Have I not told ye before?"
They jumped back from this voice, startled. Sister Mary looked particularly annoyed. But she stepped back with one final glare, Roland would have sworn it, at the medallion lying on his chest. He had tucked it back under the bed-dress at his last waking, but it was out again now. A sixth sister appeared, pushing rudely in between Mary and Tamara.